One of Matt Richtel's favorite stories about creativity comes from the Bible. It's in the book of Exodus, where Moses comes upon God in the form of a burning bush on a mountain. God, the bush, wants Moses to lead the children of Israel out of bondage. And as the story goes, they were being held captive by the Pharaoh of Egypt. God wants Moses for the job, but Moses, who's busy being a sheep herder, isn't really interested.
God essentially says, "Hey, Moses, I got a job for you." And Moses is like, "Nah, hard pass." When I started writing this book, I was struck by how powerful the metaphor is for creativity, because a lot of us get struck by an idea or an inspiration. And what our response is, many times, is, "I am not worthy. You got the wrong guy." Now, ultimately, God really has to prove to Moses he's the right guy. But if you think about that metaphor, it is a beautiful opening for a conversation about creativity to me, in that no matter how powerful you feel or how worthy you might wind up being, that blinding light of inspiration can be a real mixed blessing for you.
It's interesting. Basically, Moses is talking back to God. And it's one of the things you say in the book, is that people are constantly grappling with a creator. Like, if you're not religious or inclined that way, you're grappling with, you know, your own primal makeup. That seems like one of the central ideas about creativity, is we're fighting it always.
Yeah, you can make a case that this search for your own self and your own authenticity, your inner creator, is a really big act of grappling with permission, grappling with whether you feel worthy. And in many ways, you are talking back to your inner creator as if the God inside you saying, "I'm going to keep you at arm's length." It is actually separately an astounding bit of storytelling in the Bible that Moses, this seminal character, is willing to say to the Creator, "I turn away from you, I'm talking back to you." And I think I have made the case that we are, many of us, talking back to our inner Creator and resisting the power of that entity, creature, idea, notion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In his new book called Inspired, the New York Times reporter Matt Richtel makes a lot of connections like that to explain just how creativity works, like the process of evolution, genes mutating and changing. That's creativity, he says. And he says a virus is creative and a dictator is creative, because creativity isn't good or bad. It just is, he says. In fact, it's the operating principle for life. And he talked to a lot of people for the book, the ones you would expect, the musicians and athletes and inventors. But he also talked to astrophysicists who told him creativity is like the birth of the universe. At first, it's intense and chaotic, but over time, something like an idea emerges.
Inside our brains, there are all these ideas, fragments, dots from the vast reaches in the galaxies of our subconscious. And they are, if not chaos, then these disconnected pieces that have no meaning in and of themselves and suddenly crystallize. I'll come back to Moses for a second. It's like a burning bush, a moment that calls out to us, these pieces have coalesced. Here they are. Will you recognize them? Will you accept them? And then those ideas get run over the rugged parts of our intellect, our consciousness, our prefrontal cortex, and we bring them order and birth them into life like a universe. Or, Doug, we resist that burning bush and let it pass, and the universe never gets born.
I think it's important to say, as you lay out in the book, that creativity is not good or bad necessarily. Say something about that, because I think that a lot of us think of creativity as having as being a good thing. But there are all kinds of crappy, terrible things that can be perceived as creative as well.
Yeah, and I'll get even weirder for a second, Doug. I struggle to even understand what good and bad is at times. I could tell you in an individual instance, person A hurts person B. That is bad. But if you think about an invention, an idea, a policy, a piece of technology, its use is not predetermined. Let's just simply take the atomic bomb. Mm. It mm. brought an end to a world war and a lot of suffering. It created a lot of suffering. And I defy any person to tell me what the end result of the invention of the atomic bomb will be for our world. Let's take a contemporary example, the electric vehicle. Mm. So if you're Elon Musk or anybody involved in that business, you are seeing a soaring business opportunity. And many people see an opportunity to diminish climate change. But there are lots of people in industries that are reliant on coal and gas cars that are seeing their fortunes potentially change. So there's the long-term question of the value of the moral value, if you will, of an invention creation. And then there's the fact that even in the short term, these can be good for some and horrible, if not even death, for others. Mm. Can I get a little weird and talk pandemic?
Yeah.
Look, COVID-19 is, by some measures, a brilliant creation. It is a mass market smash hit. And there's a reason for that that has to do with why creativity works when it catches on. When creativity really catches on, something is similar enough to what has come before to fit into the superstructure of our lives.
Yeah.
But different enough to provide something new. And in the case of this virus, the different enough was that it flummoxed our immune systems in some way. It was a coronavirus, which spreads easily, particularly in a very dense planet, densely populated planet, excuse me, with people moving around. But it brought some biology to us that we were not familiar, our immune systems were not familiar enough to deal with. That is a hugely creative development, but I wouldn't call it good.
Well, here's something you write in the book about that. And it gets to a really important point about creativity that you write about. You say this particular creation, COVID, of course. You say it took hold through a new genetic combination that happened to be a perfect fit for the world in which it was introduced. Because you say at another time in history, it may have just died on the vine. So I guess this is one of the points that in some ways creativity is about timing.
Creativity is hugely about timing. So there's this wonderful story that I heard and then verified about Bono. So after U2 wins a Grammy for the day after he wins a Grammy for Beautiful Day, he meets with a guy who's ultimately becomes a friend of mine named Roger McNamee. And Roger has been helping people figure out how to communicate over the internet with the world and do some good. And U2 wants to meet with him. And Roger has quite a track record, eventually helps found Facebook as an early investor, but then turns on Facebook hugely in a creative move of his own because he believes it becomes deleterious. Roger, big, important, interesting guy. And he says, Bono comes to him the day after the Grammy. And Roger says at this hotel in LA, U2, Bono, amazing. You guys are so creative. And Bono says, no, you got it wrong. And Roger says, give me a break. And Bono says, listen, here's what this is about. In effect, our last album was kind of a flop. And we came to understand that the reason we had been so successful, we have some talent, but was also because of the way people listened to music and the kind of technology that was used to make it in our prior albums. And then all of a sudden, what is it? The subwoofer, is that right, Doug? The subwoofer becomes prominent and our music doesn't really fit with it. And we go back to the drawing board and start to write around the subwoofer. And our talent, such as that it is, begins to collide again with where the world is. And we're back in the game. Now, it's not like U2 was any less creative when they weren't writing for the subwoofer. But now we know their names again. It's really telling about what creativity is and is not. It is a collision of inspiration and the world around you. It is not merely being creative in a vacuum. That's not enough.
Yeah. This gets us to another musician you write about in the book. And there are a number, by the way, I should mention. But Bruce Springsteen has this moment that you write about. And it gets to this idea of authenticity. Like, creativity is about embracing the authentic part of who you are. And there's this moment you tell in the book where Springsteen, which, as he relates in his Broadway show, talks about the moment when he sees Elvis Presley on the Ed Sullivan Show. And as he put it, suddenly a new world existed. And it gave him the kind of freedom to, as you say, embrace his own voice. Talk about this moment and what this tells us about creativity.
All right, Doug. So I'm struck that for my own organizational purposes, I would like to pause and create a structure here about why we're talking about what we're talking about. Because
okay,
and what I mean by that is this Springsteen moment, these moments of inspiration fall within a much broader idea. And the broader idea is that new ideas emerge and they come from some place. And what is that place? And how do we take advantage of it as individuals and as a society? I think for a long time, the phrase that many people have used is necessity is the mother of invention.
Yeah.
That where things come from is duress that requires of us to work our way out of a situation. And I argue in this book that that is actually somewhat wrong. And Springsteen's story begins to get at why. And later on, maybe I can even explain the biology that helps explain why. But the phrase I prefer is, if necessity is the mother of invention, then authenticity is the grandparent of invention.
Right.
At first comes a kind of a revelation born of a unique creature, a unique individual. Each of us is unique. A creative fingerprint that emerges that in turn becomes an idea in the world that takes hold. Now, why do I emphasize the word authenticity here? Well, for something to be creative by definition, it is new. It doesn't have to be great. It doesn't have to make a huge impact. It can make even a small one. But for something to be new, it has to represent a combination of ideas, notions, sounds, sights that we have not experienced before. And I think the place where that most resides in the human species is in the unique collection that makes someone an individual. It doesn't mean that you and I, Doug, wouldn't be able to come up with similarly creative solutions to a problem. But it means that the biggest advantage either of us has is drawing on our authentic nature. Are you following me?
Yeah. Should we back up and talk about how creativity is part of a kind of a primitive physiology?
There? Yeah. And this, I'm so glad you asked that, Doug. Sorry. And then I interrupted you because you got me excited.
Well, explain this, because you say it's like what you're saying is creativity is this operating principle for life. How change alters our genetics. Sometimes it works in the process of evolution. Sometimes it doesn't. It's of course unconscious and random, but that's creativity, I guess.
Right. So I've talked to artists, business people, billionaires, Nobel Prize winning scientists, MacArthur geniuses, all in the book. But wait a second. What are we really talking about here at the biological level? So I wind up talking to a guy named Andreas Wagner, who he runs a lab where he tries to look at bacteria and creativity. What can he learn at the really basic level of an organism? And inside his lab, he takes bacteria and he bombards them with antibiotics. He basically annihilates them. And most of them, well, guess what happens? They cutting room floor.
Yeah.
But then occasionally, a bacteria reproduces in such a way that it develops a defense against that antibiotic and it survives. Doug, let me just ask you, on its face, does that seem creative to you?
I suppose it does.
So here's why I would call it such. New bacteria is in effect the future. That is the progress of that bacteria. Now, how did it come about? Well, there was necessity. Absent the antibiotic, this particular idea would not have taken hold. But before there was necessity, there was a random mutation that found its niche because of the environment around it. And that is a deeply, I don't even know if the word's authentic. It's unconscious. It's unconscious. It's an accident. It's a marvelous moment of newness that allows an idea, or in this case, an organism, to thrive. And when I think about inspiration and then creativity at its most core, it is the emergence of an idea mutation, a change in ideas that, owing to the circumstances around us, takes hold to a greater or lesser degree. Look, I can go into my fridge when the kids need dinner and there's only four ingredients and come up with something no one's, well, I was going to say no one's made before. What I really say is none of my kids will eat anyway. But there is something fundamentally creative about the way my brain came up with an accidental way to mix those things up and the kids had dinner. That is a creation. It is creative. The reason I tie this to authenticity ultimately when we come to the bigger quote unquote creations is these accidents, these mutations, this gathering newborn universe, as you alluded to earlier, really is peculiar to individual people, or can be. And the only way to get at that is to allow yourself and give yourself permission to look at the ingredients that are there, or the accidents that pop up, the mutations, and give them value.
Yeah. But let's talk about why it is, though, that we resist creativity, because that is primal, you say. And I think this gets at what you were just talking about. From a biological perspective, you say creativity is death. So there's a new form of life, or there's a new idea. When that emerges, it has to kill the past in the both a sort of real way and also in the kind of metaphorical way, I think. So talk about, is that why it is that, I mean, on a biological level anyway, we resist it? I mean, new ideas scare, as you say in the book, scare the heck out of us. Talk about that resistance part.
Well, when I start this book, when I start any book, there tend to be these moments where I hear a study or meet a person and I go, oh yeah, now we're onto something.
Yeah.
Me and my muse, we got something to dig into. And that happened with the subject you brought up here, and a scholar named Jack Giancollo, who is quite creative himself. And he looks at creativity in interesting ways. And he goes, he asks the question, he goes, do we actually really like being creative or do we really value it? And you go, well, that's, come on, Jack, really?
Of course we do.
Of course we do. So Jack asks this question and he goes and asks people, he goes and asks them, what do you think about creativity? And they're like, oh, rainbow. They associate, they make, he makes us, they make associations, rainbows and sunshine and puppy dog. And then he runs what's called a subconscious bias test. These are the tests that get run to see subconsciously how people feel and determine whether how they feel subconsciously differs from what they say they feel. The place where we most know this is around race. A classic example is the person of such and such skin color. I feel consciously, I feel totally okay. Subconsciously, I walk across the street because I'm afraid. So Jack runs this research and he finds out that subconsciously the control group actually associates that they say they, you know, rainbows and puppies and whatever it is, but subconsciously associate creativity with vomit and toxins and poison. And he's like, well, what? You hit on part of it with death, but before we get there, there's some interim steps about why creativity is so scary. And they're really, when I learned them, it provided me great insight into both my own process and the processes and challenges of people around me. So here's the thing. If you've got a way of doing things and it more or less works, there's a huge switching cost. I mean, think of creativity as going from Verizon to AT&T in your cable. Like, you got to redo the bill. You got to learn a new system. How does the remote control work? On some level, when you change, there is the risk that it won't work. There is the change to the status quo of how you behave. There is the idea that you might be worse off than you were to begin with. And what winds up happening is that for everything we say we consciously feel, we wind up very frightened of creativity and creators. Mm-hmm. They mess up our resource flow. They threaten how we use our energy. On a very basic primal level, they force us to make a choice between an okay way things are going, but we know the devil, to the devil we don't know. Mm-hmm. If you play it out further, Doug, we know viscerally on some level that the thing that's new is going to kill the thing that came before. The electric vehicle could well kill the gas car. That's super bad for people who own a gas car and desire it as an asset, for people who are in the business, for people who own shares of, I don't know, whatever the company is, Chevron, excuse me. You could say the same of vaping and cigarettes. Lots of people say they want to get away from cigarettes. Lots of people are addicted to nicotine and lots of investors are involved in cigarettes.
So being creative means we have to confront a primal fear.
An absolute primal fear. And in that's at the kind of philosophical level, Doug, or the societal level. But let's talk about on a personal level.
Yeah.
If you throw an idea into the world where you're following a template and playing more or less by the rules, you have a good chance of having that thing be accepted. And that is in many ways, no, not in many ways, it is fundamentally socially safe and maybe more to the point, economically safe.
Yeah.
You can make a fair case, I think, that most of our decisions have an economic basis, like, is this a good use of time? Is this going to return to me with dividends how I spent my time? Let's think about Springsteen for a second. Like Springsteen at one point, I know from his memoir, fires his band when they're doing, essentially disbands it early on in the 70s, I think, or late 60s, when they're doing pretty well, but he knows it's not the sound he wants.
Yep.
Could the Bruce Springsteen of 1970 have had any notion that he was going to wind up on the cover of Time and Newsweek the same week as the first artist ever to do that? No way. He followed a muse. And he took an immense risk.
Matt Richtel, he's a reporter for the New York Times. His new book is Inspired, Understanding Creativity, A Journey Through Art, Science, and the Soul. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
A broken down or unused vehicle can be a hassle. Declutter your driveway by donating your unwanted vehicle to NPR Utah. Vehicle donations help fund the public radio programming and local independent journalism that you rely on from KUER, and they're even tax deductible. KUER accepts cars, trucks, motorcycles, SUVs, and even boats. And we'll handle every step of the process. Learn more and get started today at KUER.org/vehicle.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the reporter Matt Richtel is with us. He describes his latest book as the story of how we create. It's about authenticity and openness, being willing to peer over the edge and take a leap of faith. The book is called Inspired. Let's talk about Jim Allison. James Allison, the immunologist, won the Nobel Prize. And one of the things you write about in the book and that you say about him is he stays away from reading all these medical journal papers. What does that say about him? Tell us his story.
So first of all, what did he do? Well, he helped understand in the most basic way how we can help our immune systems fight cancer, a concept many people now know as immunotherapy. His revelation was nothing shy of extraordinary in that he understood that that cancer was playing a trick on the immune system to get it to basically stand down and not fight. And he figured out how to get the cancer to get the immune system to recognize the cancer. Now, in one half sentence, why is that so revelatory? Well, chemotherapy, for anybody who's been through this or knows, basically is scorched earth. You're killing your own body. And he's figuring out a way to get the immune system to do what it should. Mind blowing. Jim Allison he describes himself as a very hard-headed guy. He's also a guy who doesn't seem to need notoriety. He doesn't seem to need, the idea feels foremost to him, not the outcome. And so when he's searching for ideas, I think a lesser part of Jim Allison than many of us has an eye to how it's going to be received. If he was thinking that way, he might be reading those other papers thinking, those ideas are going to give me a way to participate in this system. But he's reading and basing his decisions on, look, no small amount of expertise, but also trusting his gut, his authentic instinct, and it has changed the world.
You point out the book isn't at all a memoir, of course, but you do mention your own story and how that works in this larger story. Do you want to say something about what happens in 1991? You turned your life into scorched earth. Speaking of scorched earth,
yeah, I'm happy to do it, Doug. And I'm thinking that of this. A few weeks ago, I got a Washington Post review that was really the kind of thing you dream about. But in the review, the reviewer says, he goes, Matt writes about himself and says he doesn't want to dwell on it. And then the reviewer says, would you please dwell? And while I appreciate you asking, I guess I was cautious not to want to take the limelight away from all these amazing creators. But I do understand the question in that I do know what it feels like to transform from being someone unable to hear his own voice into someone who hears his own voice and indulges it in spades.
Yeah.
And so in that respect, you know, whether or not I'm any good at it, whatever that even means, I do understand the transition. So in short, I'm speaking to you here from neighboring Colorado, where I grew up. And Boulder is, as probably lots of you know, not a very big place and was smaller then. And my dad was a law professor turned judge. And I kind of got this idea, and he was like a big thinker. He read like those giant nonfiction books that were 800 pages and told you all about the world. And I also grew up a bit of a jock. And between those two things, I created a vision for myself that was like, I don't know, part JFK Camelot, part Mickey Mantle, part strong, silent type, none of which I was, and certainly none of which I am. And in my 20s, as I was working in journalism and I was being offered promotions and thinking that somehow if I just got ahead, whatever that meant, things would feel okay, I collapsed. I mean, Doug, full on emotional mess for 2 years. First, I thought I was sick, and then I realized I was really in it. Now, I do risk aggrandizing this when, in fact, I was just going through my 20s, and lots of people do it. But during that period—
But it was a big deal for you.
It was a massive deal, and there were times I thought I would not survive.
Yeah.
And the reason I did goes to the heart of why people can create. At some point, I understood that I no longer could or needed to ask anybody else what I should do or say or think or who I was, that I was just me, and whatever that thing is fine.
But wait, take me to that moment, because one of the things you write about is you are talking to your therapist, pleading, tell me what is wrong. This is how you put it in the book. You say, I was an enigma to myself, wrapped in the fetal position. Why was I sobbing? Who was I? And then here's the next sentence. Finally, I quit asking.
I can see the day, Doug, and I didn't write it, but I can see the day. So here's the day. So I've told you how I used to kind of frame myself. And at the time, I'm living with my college sweetheart, and we have two cats. And I'm sitting on the couch, and my ex-girlfriend says, our cat needs to go in and be put to sleep. And the cat's name was Hazel. Big, fat cat with hazel eyes who had a strange scent about her and had developed cancer. Doug, I don't know if I've ever told this story. And I take the cat into a Berkeley veterinary clinic to be put down. As they're putting Hazel down, I start to sob. And I come home and I'm sitting on this futon couch and I start to sob. And I realize, and I can't give you any other magic than this or insight, I realize that my feelings are okay, and I am in touch with a self that I feel entirely comfortable with. And I realize that that sounds so mystical to people who might be wondering, where do I find that place? But I'll give you some intellectualized words that may make sense of it that later on I came to understand. I met a guy who was an AA, I quote in this book, who's in Utah. He's in Utah. I think northern Utah, maybe around Logan. He's in AA and he's trying to get over all these difficult addictions, pills and alcohol. He said that for me, the center of self-acceptance so that I didn't need to rely on anything else. And I say anything else, but I could also use the phrase anyone else.
Right. Right.
Is this phrase. And it's, to me, it lies at the in the center, the gooey center of creativity. The phrase is, I am worthy, but I am no more worthy. And what that means to me, and maybe it means other things to other people, is I understood in that moment that I was just as worthy as a therapist or a parent, a girlfriend, anybody else to have my opinions about myself or the world or to write whatever I wanted. But I'm no more worthy than anyone else. And the second half of that sentence doesn't mean what it appears to mean. It doesn't mean exclusively, I'm not better than you. Although it does include that. What it means is, it takes all the pressure off a creator or a human being to have to be good or better or any of those hierarchical words, because fundamentally, I am no more worthy. It doesn't matter if I put out Beautiful Day or Springsteen or win a Nobel Prize. I am no more worthy. And it takes the pressure off all that risk that impedes creativity, because it's not going to make you a better person anyway, or a worse person if you fail.
You mentioned a couple of things in this part of the book that when you talk about this. You mentioned gratitude. You mentioned a deep sense of humility. You mentioned that the idea of judging. You say that in the most significant way, I was no longer judging myself.
Yep.
And the less I judged, the more I could explore without threat. So that idea of getting away from judging yourself, or I suppose even others, that's one of the keys to creativity.
Others, it's the same thing. You start to be able to see material. Yeah. Let's go back to that, the accidents of mutation, okay?
Right.
Or
right.
The scattered particles of an unborn universe. You start to view those through a lens that has far less ego associated. There is, when you frame an idea of yourself or preordain an idea of the world around you or what has to happen next, you cannot draw on material that flies in the face of that thing. So this takes us, in fact, to a question you and I talked about prior to the interview about religion. When you create a worldview that is fairly rigid, what it does is prohibits you, prejudges how much material you can draw from. So no matter what neat, authentic stuff you have in you, if you have prejudged the outcome or the window dressing, the ornamentation, the fundamentals, any of it, you can't draw on that material. You're toast. Yeah. You're done before you started. Remember Jack Giancarlo, this wonderful researcher who got me so inspired with the vomit stuff?
Yeah.
He wanted to know, he got together with a bunch of people who actually had come from different religious backgrounds. He felt he needed to do that to ask, what is the relationship between religious belief, specifically belief in God, and creativity? What he found was, if you're really thinking about a particular God or a particular monotheistic view of the world that is really well-formed, it is hard for you to be as creative as someone who doesn't. That just stands to reason. There are ideas you can't allow into your brain. Therefore, you can't physically or figuratively see the material around you. But that doesn't mean people who are religious can't be wildly creative. And the distinction is how you see what your creator wants of you. It brings us all the way back to Moses, Doug. If you're someone who sees of a God, who defines a God as an entity that wants creativity, that allows for or celebrates the idea of novel, random, interesting, mutative, is that a word? Mutative ideas, then absolutely you can do it. It just depends on how you view what that creator wants.
Matt Richtel, his new book is Inspired, Understanding Creativity, A Journey Through Art, Science, and the Soul. We'll take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Thanks to KUER's mobile app, you can keep NPR Utah as your essential connection wherever you go. Our free mobile app keeps you informed with the latest local stories from KUER News. Explore on-demand podcasts like Radio West, State Street, and Sent Away. Or enjoy nonstop streams of our daily programming, BBC World Service, and classical KUER. Stay connected to your member station with the KUER mobile app, available for free wherever you get your apps.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the New York Times reporter Matt Richtel. His new book is an exploration of how creativity works It's called Inspired. If you'll indulge me for a second, I want to get to this song that you wrote. And this isn't something you write about in your book, but in the new-ish Beatles documentary, Get Back, there's this, I wanted to ask you about this one astonishing moment where Paul McCartney, there's this kind of lull in the action, in the rehearsal. Paul, George, and Ringo, they're sitting around and they're waiting for John. And Paul starts messing around on this guitar he has. And at first, it's nothing like the song that it's going to become. I mean, there aren't really words. It's just a feeling. He's just kind of putting chords together. And then something starts to happen. Something about it starts to work. And he kind of starts going with it. And there aren't any words at first. And it's not a story. It's just making sounds. And then he finds, and it's such a miraculous moment, especially if you're a Beatles fan, he finds the central melody of Get Back.
Yeah.
And you see that moment of creation. What are you seeing in that moment?
First of all, I'm seeing myself watching it being blown back through the wall of my house.
Yeah.
Like, are you kidding me? You can't. I wrote this before. I don't even know what I would have done if I had seen that before I started writing. I might have
crazy.
Just thrown
my
head
crazy.
Out and said, forget it. Just watch that moment. But what I see is something that's actually going to bring me to another creator in the book named Judd Apatow, the comedic director and a really interesting guy. What I see is a moment of mutation. Happening in an environment that is incredibly receptive, where he's able to be extremely free and where ideas pile upon ideas in an incredibly magnetic way in that moment, and one of our great songs is born. If you haven't seen that moment, it's as crystallizing for creativity as any. And then the look, what happens after that, and I mentioned the word expertise, is a whole bunch of expertise gets thrown onto that, combined with a series of other authentic moments, like John saying something, them changing either where the character comes from or the character's gender, I can't remember, but they're little authentic moments that then get mixed in with expertise. But the expertise doesn't matter absent the authenticity. Judd Apatow tells me this story when I start talking about the neurology or the neuroscience of creativity. He tells me the story of a comedic writer's room. And I think he tells me two different stories. One is the writer's room of Gary Shandling show, where he was at a very young age. And the other one is the writer's room of, it's a show, I think it's on HBO, where a comedian sleeps on different couches. And he says, when you're in a comedic writer's room, you have to let yourself go. You have to let yourself be humiliated. You share everything. You share stories that can even come across as horrific, bigoted, but you're not doing it because you're a bigot. You're doing it because you're sharing your fears, your innermost truths, your authentic self. And he said what happened in the Gary Shandling show, so that is the effect, the subconscious. Remember, drawing on all these ideas from these snippets, these unconnected dots. In the Gary Shandling show, he said there was such a fear that Gary was so good and wanted things a certain way that it ultimately inhibited what a comedian would allow to come out of his or her mouth. And the subconscious was in some ways shut down. And in this other show, like, do you hear the cat trying to get outside? That is not muttering.
That's okay.
Huge Judd Apatow fan, our cat Pickles.
Yeah. The show is crashing, by the way.
Crashing. So he says at Crashing, the head writer and the star of that show is like, lays himself bare more than anybody could do. And he creates an environment where the writer's room becomes like the subconscious of your brain. That is just letting everything pop up. You just go. And then the writers collectively act like the intellect and begin to pare those ideas down. So you get this authentic outpouring followed by this sort of rugged landscape of the intellect, trying to determine if the idea is any good. But before they determine if the idea is good, they let the idea have life.
You know, you're a pretty good example of all of this. It seems like, I don't know if it's courage. You wrote, you know, the things that you've done, a children's book. I mean, I could go down the line. Say something about the song you wrote. Like, what is it that gave you the kind of audacity to do something like that?
Trying to destroy my marriage? But, well, look, first of all, I've written in the last few years, I've written probably 100 songs. I think that part of allowing myself to be whatever it is that comes up was realizing that all along there was a pretty big passion for music. And then I had some expertise in how to tell stories, and I started to learn how to do this and decided that one of the songs I wanted to write was a story of creativity. And this song is called From Darkness, and it's about Homer hearing Helen's voice and writing the Odyssey.
Man in the dust.
Look, can I just add one thing to that, though?
Yeah, of course.
Fear comes in. Like, I have about a 4-note singing range where I can stay on pitch. So it is absolutely terrifying to sing and play in front of other people. And there are times I absolutely do not enjoy that experience. And then there are times when I allow myself to let go completely on the theory that I am worthy, but no more worthy. And I am definitely in this case less worthy as a singer. But if people are willing, understanding the social contract that we have to get together and try that, I say, why not me?
Man in the dust, lonely and bruised. Penniless dreamer with no clue. How'd I get the girl who inspires a feeling inside him like fire?
There's this moment you write about in the book where you can actually see everyone, can actually see this, actually see inspiration come alive. And this is back in 2018. It's in August of that year when the cellist Yo-Yo Ma gives this brief concert. It's on the internet. You write about this. And you write about the idea that where the inspiration is really unfolding isn't just so much in his playing, which is amazing, of course. But you say it's in his face.
Yeah.
I
thought the minute I saw it, I was like, that's a topographical map of his soul. Like, huh. His face is twitching and moving, and the muscles are tightening and loosening. Their valleys and mountains are being created. Emotion is being reflected with a looseness, openness that is the essence of the thing we're describing. He is saying, you know, it's even like more primitive than him saying, I am Yo-Yo Ma, here I am. It's like, I am this creature. This is it. You're looking at it. The amount, you used the word courage earlier, and the reason I wrestle with that word often myself, Doug, is that on one level, it seems incredibly apt when someone puts themselves out there. On the other hand, is when you get to the point of saying, I am worthy, but no more worthy, it stops feeling like courage exactly. It feels like it is. That you are just as entitled. Look, people have a right to turn you off. No one has to listen to a song I write or read a book I write or, you know, in the case of Yo-Yo Ma, or go to a Springsteen concert or whatever the thing is. But when you start to become allow a creator inside you to thrive, people's reaction to it becomes just as unnecessary as a therapist telling you why you're crying.
Yeah.
And Yo-Yo Ma's like, hey, here I am, baby.
Well, he said that it's about that willingness to peer over the edge. That's how you mention it. He said, you have to take that leap. And I love how he explains it to you, or you describe it in the book. He said it was like falling in love. So I guess what sets Ma and creators who do this apart is they have... It's about faith, right?
Yeah, I think so. I think that they feel an incredible, they see the burning bush and they say that the voice of the Creator is one worth following. And not only worth following, but that something amazing will happen. Set my people free. That you will be set free if you have the faith in following that inspiration, the light, the burning bush of creation.
Matt Richtel, thanks very much.
Thank you, Doug.
Matt Richtel, he's a reporter for the New York Times. His book is Inspired: Understanding Creativity, A Journey Through Art, Science, and the Soul. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. The program is produced by Kerry Watson, Benjamin Bombard, and Tim Slover. Stephanie Allerton is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.